2014 European elections as well. But overall, if you look at the trends, if you can see, as you say, this was 28 national elections. The populist right did extremely well in Italy. Salvini didn't do well at all in Germany, lost that seat in the Netherlands. Marine Le Pen, that's a sort of the far right party in France, right, came on top of President Macron, but did less well than 5 years ago. So it's difficult to see that as sort of surge in the support for her.
Okay.
Really, sort of the Greens and the Liberals were the winners of the day, somewhat as a surprise, has to be said. And then another result that should be noted is the fairly significant increase in turnout, not in every country, but in most of the countries, significant increase in interest in these elections, which I think is a healthy sign.
Is the danger that the European Union is seen as being in actually what's driving that higher turnout?
Well, I think there's first, there has been a more interesting debate in a number of countries. Secondly, I think there's an increasing awareness of that we live in a world of Brexit, of Trump, of Putin, of China, and it is more important for Europeans to stay together and see what we can do together. That reluctant recognition, I think, has been one of the themes that have been there in the debate in virtually every country.
So you are pushing in a way, or not pushing, but you're advocating a different view of these elections than some might see. Despite some gains from the populists, it sounds like you perceive some bedrock support for the idea of a united Europe.
Yeah. I mean, there was an increase by the far right, but I mean, fairly marginal and far less than most people had predicted or most people had feared. And there was a bigger gain for the Greens and the Liberals than people had anticipated. The decline for the main parties, the EPP, the centre-right main party, and the Social Democratic Party, was broadly foreseen.
When you mentioned the various threats that Europeans may feel that they face, you mentioned Vladimir Putin of Russia. Of course, there was a huge controversy over Russian interference in the U.S. election in 2016. There has been some investigation of Russian involvement in the Brexit debate in the U.K. Was Russia perceived as some kind of player in these elections?
As some kind of player, most probably, but that's hardly news. I mean, the Russians have been active with propaganda and with political means to trying to influence European countries forever. It normally backfires. There was, of course, the scandal in Austria, you might have noted that, where it was disclosed that they had been, or the far-right party had been trying to, believing that they went into some sort of agreement with Russia and selling out Austrian interest. That has collapsed the Austrian government and led, of course, to significant loss for that particular party.
So when you look at this mix of seats and party groups in the European Parliament, do you see a parliament that can function and move forward on any particular agenda?
I think it's going to be a more complicated parliament than before, because in this still sitting parliament, you had the EPP, centre-right, and the centre-left grouping together had a majority, and they often agreed on things. They no longer have that majority, and they will have to go into coalition agreements on different issues with primarily the Liberals, I would say, and to some extent the Greens, hardly with the far-right. So it's going to be a somewhat more complicated parliamentary work ahead during the next 5 years. And then of course it's all done in a co-decision procedure with the 27 or 28 governments.
Going to be complicated. Mr. Bildt, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Carl Bildt is the co-chair of the European Council on Foreign Relations and the former Swedish Prime Minister. He joined us via Skype.
Venezuela's opposition has been trying for months to oust the authoritarian president Nicolas Maduro, but Maduro isn't budging. So now the two sides are meeting in Norway in an effort to resolve this protracted political crisis. Reporter John Otis has the story.
Angel Gallardo sells vegetables in the western city of Maracaibo, but his store is mostly empty. Gasoline shortages keep many shoppers home. The city is also plagued by blackouts, which mean that refrigerators often don't work. Gallardo says shoppers buy only what they need for their next meal, like a few tomatoes and onions. Gallardo supports opposition leader Juan Guaido, who is recognized by more than 50 countries, including the U.S., as Venezuela's legitimate head of state. But over the past 5 months, efforts by Guaido to force President Maduro from power have failed. The stalemate prompted both sides to sit down earlier this month for exploratory talks in Norway.
Sale a Noruega a continuar el diálogo, a continuar las conversaciones, a buscar la paz, siempre buscar la paz.
In a TV appearance Saturday, Maduro confirmed that there will be a second round of meetings in Oslo this week. The news came as a surprise because opposition leaders have long dismissed negotiations. They claim Maduro used previous talks to stall for time while making no concessions.
Que no nos vamos a prestar para ningún tipo de negociación falsa.
At a recent news conference, Guaido declared, "We are not going to take part in false negotiations." But at this point, the opposition has few options, says pollster and political analyst Luis Vicente León.
If you have the power to kick Maduro out, you are right. You don't need to negotiate. The problem is that you are saying that with Maduro in power, which means that you have not the force and the power to do it. Why Maduro is still there? Because you cannot kick him out.
Meanwhile, analysts say several factors could prompt Maduro to cut a deal. These include U.S. sanctions that are squeezing Venezuela's vital oil income. Maduro also fears that the military, which props up his regime, could turn against him, says Jeff Ramsey of the Washington Office on Latin America, a policy and human rights group.
The set of political and economic interests that is currently sustaining Maduro in power, I think would be very happy to throw him under the bus and replace him with someone that has much more international legitimacy.
The opposition insists that negotiations must focus on holding a free and fair presidential election, but there is a long way to go. During the initial talks, the two sides spoke separately with the Norwegian mediator rather than to each other. Some within the opposition fear that Maduro is once again pulling their leg. But here in Maracaibo, as life gets harder by the day, residents like Alexander Perez are desperate for a breakthrough. Perez is a high school principal, but his earnings have been devastated by hyperinflation. Perez says he used to spend more per day on bus fare than he would earn at his school. He now walks to work. Negotiations are the best solution, Perez says. That way we will avoid bloodshed and even more pain than we're already suffering. John Otis, NPR News, Maracaibo, Venezuela.
Later today on All Things Considered, more on the political crisis in Venezuela, where lawmakers who support the opposition face threats, arrest, and sometimes exile. To listen, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or ask for your local member station by name. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and it's 8:19. NPR has been talking to candidates for the 2020 presidential race in a series called Opening Arguments. And today, Noel King will speak with former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper about his campaign to be the Democratic nominee. That's in about 15 minutes.
Tiny homes are trendy, yes, and affordable, both important in oh-so-expensive Silicon Valley.
Buying a home is not even an option. At this point, it's paying for rent is difficult, to be honest with you.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Backyard homes and the affordable housing crisis, next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from UW-Madison. UW-Madison is committed to helping students increase their earning potential through finding careers and job offers, as well as enrolling in graduate or professional school. Impact.wisc.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kindred Life Golf Outing will take place Friday, June 11th at White Deer Run Golf Club in Vernon Hills. Participation supports teen parents and their families to become self-sufficient. More information at kindredlife.org.
Here's what the weather looks like today. Cloudy with a good chance of showers and thunderstorms across the state. Some of the thunderstorms in the south might be strong in the afternoon with heavy rain and gusty winds and highs in the 60s. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with rain and thunderstorms for the central and southern parts of Wisconsin. Some of the storms could be heavy at times, highs in the low to mid 70s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Serta, offering the Serta Perfect Sleeper at local retailers, featuring a layer designed to cradle the body from head to toe for pressure relief. Available now at participating Serta retailers. From TransferWise, which was built to make it easier to send money internationally, 4 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, receive, and convert currencies in more than 70 countries. More at TransferWise.com. And from Creative Planning, whose fiduciary advisors look beyond age and risk tolerance to manage clients' investments. More at creativeplanning.com/NPR. Creative Planning. Wealth management redefined.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Anybody who has a kid with a fever makes a discovery at the drugstore. There are two options for Tylenol, one for infants, one for children. They contain the same amount of medicine, but the infant version costs three times more. Why would that be? Here's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin.
Turns out there's a backstory. For a long time, infants' Tylenol was stronger than the children's stuff.
It was three times more concentrated.
That's Inma Hernandez of the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy. The thinking was, you don't want to give little babies lots of liquid medicine, and you can give them less if it's stronger. Hence the cost difference.
The price per milliliter was five times higher.
But there was a problem. Parents were making mistakes with dosing. Babies got sick, and some even died. So at the urging of the Food and Drug Administration in 2011, Johnson & Johnson announced a change.
Infant's Tylenol is now offered in the same concentration as children's Tylenol.
But the price is still different. With store brands of acetaminophen, it's the same story. The infant version is generally three times more than the one for children. I asked Johnson & Johnson, the maker of brand-name Tylenol, why. The company says the infant version comes in a sturdier bottle and has a syringe for accurate dosing. The children's version only has a little plastic cup. Inma Hernandez isn't convinced by that. She says what's expensive in producing a drug like this is the active ingredient, not a piece of plastic.
The cap versus the syringe doesn't really explain the price difference, in my opinion.
But Johnson & Johnson's explanation makes sense to Edgar Dworsky. He's a consumer advocate and founder of the website Consumer World.
There's an extra thing in the box, and extra things usually cost money.
He says there's a convenience element here.
Think of, you know, a spray cleaner. You can buy the spray cleaner in the spray bottle, and that costs a little more money. Or you can buy the refill. That gives you more ounces, but it doesn't have the sprayer on top. It's kind of the same concept.
But this, of course, is not a spray cleaner. It's medicine for your baby. Parents can be sensitive to marketing because the stakes are so high. Dr. Ankur Shah at Children's National in Washington, D.C., says when it comes to infant and children's acetaminophen, the most important thing is to get the dosing right.
When you start giving more than recommended, there are serious side effects that could happen.
So the bottom line, know what you need. If spending that extra couple of dollars for the syringe will help you get the dosing just right, maybe the markup is worth it. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
All right, you might not think of a prenatal checkup as a thing that brings strangers together and becomes a kind of community, but that is exactly what reporter Jenny Gold found.
I'd always imagined having a baby surrounded by my family and friends. But when I found out I was pregnant, my husband and I had just moved from San Francisco to Chicago. I hardly knew a soul. I looked for friends at work, in prenatal yoga classes, at the bookstore, but I ended up finding a community where I least expected it, at a medical office.
How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm a little tired. You're listening to the audio I recorded at my 38-week pregnancy visit at Northwestern Medicine. I'm lying on an exam table behind a curtain as midwife Carol Hirschfeld searches for the baby's heartbeat.
Oh, there he is.
So far, it seems like your average prenatal visit. But just on the other side of that curtain are six other couples waiting for their turn. We're part of a program called Centering Pregnancy. Instead of individual 15-minute prenatal visits, you meet as a group for 2 hours. After the brief medical check, we sit in a circle to talk about all the crazy things happening to our bodies. There's a curriculum focused on things like nutrition, relationships, and labor. But mostly we just talk, prompted by the two midwives who lead the group, Carol Hirschfeld and Arielle Derringer.
The things that we passed around are some quotes. If you want to say something, a wish, or something that you're feeling, does anyone want to start?
So the quote that I have is, "The greatest gift a couple can give a baby is a loving relationship."
It sounds a lot like a support group. And that's part of the point. The goal here is to provide medical care and educate, yes, but also to reduce stress and isolation.
The biggest positive outcome here is the growth of community, having people go through the most difficult transition in their life with other women going through the same thing.
Years of studies, many focusing on teen and low-income moms, have found that babies born to women in centering groups are less likely to be born premature, and that saves money. More than $22,000 for every premature birth that can be prevented. Over the past 5 years, the number of practices that offer centering has nearly doubled to 600. Most of the groups are led by midwives, and about half are in community health centers that serve mainly low-income women. But private practices are jumping in, too. I was in Northwestern's very first group.
As word spreads and as people talk about their experience, I think people will be asking us instead of us asking them. My vision in the future is really an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in.
I worried at first that I might miss out on one-on-one attention. What I found instead was the Chicago tribe I'd been seeking. I actually left the hospital a little early after giving birth to go to our final session. There were three brand new humans in attendance.
I didn't think I would get emotional, but God, come on.
Grace Tooman, one of the other moms in the group.
You don't feel as alone or neurotic when you can talk about things and everyone else is going through the same thing.
We moved back to California just 2 months later, but it didn't mean the end of our group. In April, my family flew all the way back to Chicago to attend a reunion in the midst of a snowstorm. Even the midwives showed up.
One, two, three.
She said, I've been tired, y'all.
This little community, forged at a medical office, is one I'm hoping to be part of for a long time to come. I'm Jenny Gold in San Francisco.
Jenny Gold is with our partner, Kaiser Health News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from MD Anderson Cancer Center, where physicians treat all types of cancers with a team of nearly 21,000, all devoted to ending cancer and providing hope to patients. More at makingcancerhistory.com. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
This is NPR News.
Nearly 30 million acres of U.S. farmland are owned by foreign investors. The numbers doubled in the past two decades.
Once a foreign entity buys up however many acres they want, Americans might not ever be able to secure that land again. And so once we lose it, we may lose it for good.
Why foreign investment in U.S. farms is raising alarm bells. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 with your host, Brady Carlson, here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
8:29 now, and thanks for listening this morning. NPR News is up next, followed by news from WPR. One of today's stories, a new bill aims to give a tax boost to volunteer firefighters across the state. Details just ahead.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is offering to mediate between the U.S. and Iran to try to ease tensions between the two countries. The offer from Abe came earlier today in Tokyo, where President Trump is wrapping up his state visit. NPR's Aisha Roscoe is in Tokyo.
President Trump is saying he thinks Iran wants to negotiate. He said the Iranian economy has suffered because of U.S. sanctions. Basically, he said if the country wants to prosper, it must prove to the U.S. it will not pursue nuclear weapons. He stressed that the U.S. is not looking for regime change, just a change in behavior.
Abe may travel to Iran as early as next month. British Prime Minister Theresa May's Conservative Party is dealing with heavy losses in European parliamentary elections. NPR's Frank Langford in London says a new party scored big wins in the UK.
With most of the ballots counted, the Brexit Party, which just launched last month, took more than 30% of the vote, while the ruling Conservative Party fell below 10%. It's the Conservatives' worst showing since the party was formed in the 1830s. Voters also punished the Labour Party while rewarding parties such as the Liberal Democrats, who advocate staying in the European Union.
May is stepping down June 7th, citing frustration over her inability to put together a Brexit deal. A court in Iraq has sentenced a fourth Frenchman to be executed for fighting with ISIS. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A new bill would give a boost to volunteer firefighters and emergency responders across Wisconsin. It's aimed at addressing a shortage that could leave Wisconsinites without services, Rob Mintzer reports.
More than 90% of Wisconsin's fire departments are staffed mostly or entirely by volunteers. But as rural populations decline, that can leave some departments dangerously shorthanded. The problem is even more acute for emergency medical personnel. Mark Cohen is executive director of the Wisconsin EMS Association.
This state is run by volunteers who give of their time freely and without compensation to save a life.
A new bill would give a tax incentive to those volunteers. It would give tax credits of between $300 and $600 to volunteer firefighters and EMS workers, plus another $900 in credits for training and equipment. Legislators say they'll seek support for the bill in coming months. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center is an education facility for youth and families on the Wisconsin River, about an hour away from the UW-Madison campus. But now the waters around the center will be patrolled by officers from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Police Department. The UWPD has jurisdiction over any UW-Madison property, thanks to the ongoing university system restructuring that now includes Upham Woods. UWPD spokesperson Mark Lovicott says the primary concern is people trespassing and launching boats from Upham Woods, which frequently operates as a youth camp.
It's mainly a safety concern because there are a lot of children that visit the area, and for a long time, random boaters would show up and just launch from that property, which is not allowed.
The boat patrols began on Saturday. A Wisconsin judge has ordered Anheuser-Busch to stop suggesting in advertising that Miller Coors light beers contain corn syrup in a preliminary ruling on a lawsuit filed by Miller Coors against its rival. U.S. District Judge William Conley for the Western District of Wisconsin Friday granted a preliminary injunction telling Anheuser-Busch to stop using the words corn syrup in ads that compare Miller Lite and Coors Light unfavorably with Bud Light without giving more context in the ad. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:34.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Bona, with the Bona Certified Craftsman Program, a network of hardwood flooring contractors committed to expertise and customer service. Contractor locator and more information are at bona.com/NPR. And from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, NA.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper sees a somewhat lonely path to the Democratic nomination for president. Hickenlooper is running as a pro-business moderate. He co-founded a brewery and eventually turned his business success into political success. He won the election to be mayor of Denver and then became a two-term governor of a purple state. Hickenlooper's belief in market-based solutions to problems puts him at odds with some other candidates in the primary. In an interview not long after he declared his candidacy, he seemed uncertain whether to call himself a capitalist. So we started there in our conversation as part of our opening argument series.
I am a capitalist, without question. I started 20 businesses. I created a couple thousand jobs. But I was trying to say that capitalism today isn't working for a large number of Americans. 75 to 80% of American families have a hard time balancing their household budgets every month. And we used to have a system when I was a kid that people would be able to get security and opportunity. Now, I think people feel nothing but anxiety.
All right, let's talk about some specifics there. Would you support a federal minimum wage?
Yeah, I think we have to increase the minimum wage. I'd expand the earned income tax credit. But I think one of the things we have to really look at is why would there are each year fewer businesses being created? And that's where job creation really comes and where quality job creation comes from.
Governor, let me have you answer your own question. Why are fewer businesses being created?
There are a combination of reasons behind the reduction in business creation. One is that we, like any enterprise, and government is an enterprise, we've had more and more kind of red tape, and sometimes that bureaucracy is excessive and makes it harder for people, the successful employees in somebody else's company, makes it harder for them to take a leap and start their own business. But I also think a big part of it is we have a consolidation of just two or three companies dominate that industry, right? They're 84% of all the hardware sales are from two companies. So starting a neighborhood hardware company is almost out of the question. People don't think they have a chance.
The question of whether or not certain companies are monopolies has come up again and again throughout the course of this campaign. Would you break up the big tech giants, Facebook and Amazon, as Elizabeth Warren has said she would do?
The tech companies cover a whole spectrum of businesses, and I think you'd have to go through the processes and procedures we have in place to look at, are they hurting competition, and are they negatively affecting the prices that consumers pay for their services and their goods?
Well, a lot of research has been done into it. What do you think? Do you think they are?
I think that Amazon, in certain ways, clearly is restraining the creation of businesses. And I think that's an important filter. That's my entrepreneurial filter. I mean, Amazon is able to see which of their vendors are most successful in selling their products. And then if Amazon decides to, they can go and acquire that specific company. That seems like an unfair competitive advantage to many people.
You said that red tape is preventing the creation of businesses. President Trump has famously made deregulation a big part of his pitch to the American people. Does President Trump have a point? Are we an overly regulated society?
When you get rid of all the regulations, as Donald Trump is suggesting, really we become incredibly vulnerable to what appear to be small decisions, but they become bigger decisions. We need regulation. What I was saying is we don't need red tape, right? While I was governor, we went through 24,500 rules and regulations, and we looked for the red tape that really is not adding regulatory value. But at the same time we were doing that, we sat down with the oil and gas industry and the environmental community, and we created a complete integrated system of regulations around what they call fugitive emissions, but escaping methane. We addressed that. We're the first state in the country, and they're now rolling that out as national policy in Canada. That kind of regulation, which actually protects the environment and is done efficiently, we desperately need. And Donald Trump is just getting rid of all regulation willy-nilly.
Democrats want to win back the Senate. And it's been said that if you chose to run against Republican Cory Gardner, that you would have a real shot in that race. Why go after the presidency instead of helping the Democratic Party win back the Senate?
Well, I've spent my whole life as an entrepreneur, as a mayor, as a governor, building teams, assembling talent. We've been able to accomplish things again and again that people didn't think we could do. We got to almost universal health care in Colorado. We did the methane regulations I described. We beat the NRA with tough new gun laws. This is all through that collaborative effort of building a team and getting things done. That's very different than the legislative process.
Has Chuck Schumer called you and urged you to run for Senate?
I've talked to Chuck Schumer, who is one of the most persuasive people, and I have more admiration for how he does his job than words can express.
You're running as a centrist, even as much of the Democratic Party is moving to the left. How do you plan to sell your ideas to an increasingly progressive party?
Well, I've talked to, obviously, I've been all over Iowa and New Hampshire, and most people really want to beat Trump. And I think if we don't stand up and say that we don't, you know, the Democrats don't stand for socialism, we're going to end up reelecting the worst president this country's ever had. And I feel sometimes a lonely voice, but I think we've got to speak loud and clear that jobs matter, our economy has to grow, and certainly we want to address income inequality. Absolutely, we want to make sure that women have a right to choose, that civil rights and social justice are addressed aggressively. But we've also got to recognize to win in Ohio and Michigan, North Carolina, and Wisconsin, we're going to have to, you know, get more to those kitchen table issues that have to do with, you know, somebody's job and or how many jobs they're having to work just to balance their household budget.
And do you think your fellow candidates are not doing that?
Well, they're certainly doing it to a certain extent. I'm not diminishing climate change or as an important issue or healthcare, but I don't think we're going to address climate change by guaranteeing every American a federal job, which is what part of the Green New Deal was. I don't think we're going to address the spiraling inflation in healthcare by forcibly telling 150 million people that we're going to take away their private insurance. You know, these are what a lot of Americans look at as facets or aspects of socialism. And I think we've got to be more focused and deliberate of saying repeatedly again and again that we want to get to address climate change, but we want to do it in a way that works.
Governor, you are a 67-year-old white man at a time when the Democratic Party says it prizes diversity. You're running against 22 other candidates. Many of them are women, people of color. Is now the time for you?
One of the things I've always loved about the Democratic Party is that it is a big tent party and it embraces opportunity for all people. And I'm running for president because I think my life experience can address this Trump-fueled national crisis of division that has been moving us backward. And I look at my experience of bringing people together, businesses and nonprofits and Republicans and Democrats, and to really get things done, to get to near universal health care, create the number one economy in the country for three consecutive years. I think that record stands for itself.
Governor John Hickenlooper, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Noel. Thank you so much.
That's former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper talking to us for our opening argument series. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, the Boston Bruins return to the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time since 2013, but the wait has been much longer for the St. Louis Blues. They were last in the finals 49 years ago. Some hockey for you coming up in 9 minutes.
If you're already a sustaining contributor to Wisconsin Public Radio, you know how great it feels to help provide entertaining, informative, and inspiring programs to make a difference in your community and beyond. If you're not a sustainer yet, take a few minutes now to set up an ongoing monthly contribution at WPR.org and find out just how great it feels.
Stay connected with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is...
Support for WGTD comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn how to lead in the expanding field of health and wellness management. Details at uwp.edu.
You're listening to WPR, and it's 8:44 now. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition today. In news, the League Party of Italy's hardline interior minister Matteo Salvini was one of the biggest winners in the European elections, with soaring support that bolsters his role as the flag bearer of the nationalist and far-right forces in Europe. And it could also shake up politics at home. With one-third of the Italian vote, the League is poised to become one of the biggest parties in the European Parliament, with 28 seats, according to provisional results. Federal and local governments have poured more than $5 billion into buying tens of thousands of private properties over the past few decades to try to diminish the long-term costs of repeated floods.
An Associated Press analysis of federal data finds that those buyouts have been getting more expensive in the last 10 years. We'll have an update on the news from NPR and WPR in 15 minutes. It'll be cloudy today with a good chance of rain and thunderstorms across the state, and we'll have highs in the 60s. It's 8:45.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Greenworks Tools, offering battery-powered outdoor tools to give people the power they need to take care of their homes. Available at Lowe's. Learn more at greenworkstools.com. From the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Who should be held accountable after police in San Francisco raided a freelance journalist's home and office? They say they were looking for information on who leaked him a police report connected to the death of the city's public defender. First Amendment lawyers say the search violated California laws that protect journalists. Initially, many city officials stood by the raid or were silent, but as criticism increased, the police chief apologized, and now the union representing San Francisco police officers is calling on the chief to resign. From member station KQED, Sonia Hudson reports.
2 weeks after the raid on Brian Carmody's home and office, Police Chief Bill Scott on Friday apologized and then criticized his own department's investigators for a, quote, lack of due diligence in seeking search warrants and in the way they dealt with Carmody as a journalist. But the police union says Scott shouldn't be blaming the investigators. Tony Montoya, president of the San Francisco Police Officers Association, says Scott himself was involved in every step of the investigation.
For the chief to deny any knowledge or to not claim that he has as much knowledge as he has to save his own skin, to me, is just unacceptable.
The case has been making headlines even before the raid. It began with the death of the city's beloved public defender, Jeff Adachi, in February. The next day, several news outlets ran stories with a leaked police report about the death. It revealed Adachi was at a friend's apartment with a woman who was not his wife, and that officers found empty bottles of alcohol and marijuana gummies. The leak enraged city officials.
To have that type of maligning going on of a public official in San Francisco is disgusting.
That's San Francisco Supervisor Hillary Ronan speaking at a city hearing in April.
We want a full investigation and we want accountability.
A few weeks later, police showed up at freelance journalist Brian Carmody's home with sledgehammers and a search warrant. He let them in.
Their guns were out as they searched my property. They handcuffed me right away, and I was in handcuffs for the next 6 to 7 hours.
Police took cameras, computers, and cell phones, everything Carmody needs to operate his business. While First Amendment advocates were quick to condemn the raid, city officials, known to be very liberal, were not. Here's Mayor London Breed a few days after the raid.
Our role is to, you know, follow the law, and the judges ultimately make the decisions. And so at this point, you know, I support their decision.
5 days after the raid, Supervisor Hillary Ronan became the first public leader to criticize it.
I'm just surprised that it wasn't obvious from the get-go to more people. It tested our city's values and commitment to free press.
Then Mayor Breed reversed course, writing in a tweet, "I am not okay with police raids on reporters." More elected officials quickly followed Breed in criticizing the raid, all the way up to Senator Kamala Harris. Now, at Breed's request, an outside agency will take over the criminal investigation of the leaked report. Police say Carmody is suspected of being a possible co-conspirator in the leak, rather than being a passive recipient of the documents. And there are three outstanding court motions in the case, including one to unseal the application for the search warrants, which could shed light on why they were approved by judges in the first place. For NPR News, I'm Sonia Hudson in San Francisco.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's about 10 minutes before 9 now. Classical music with Stephanie Elkins is on the way in about 20 minutes, starting with a suite of old American dances played by the U.S. Air Force Band. Also coming up, Barber's Adagio for strings and other music for Memorial Day. Stay with us.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Community Foundation is accepting applications for the Cropley Scholarship. All academic majors are welcome to apply for those attending a university or tech college in Wisconsin. Go to KenoshaFoundation.org.
Driveway Thrift Dwellers, the Yellow-Bellied Sapsuckers, and Chicken Wire Empire, with kids and wellness activities too. WPR is pleased to support music in our communities. Learn more at WPR.org/events.
In sports, Bart Starr, the Green Bay Packers quarterback and catalyst of Vince Lombardi's powerhouse teams of the 1960s, has died. He was 85. Starr led Green Bay to 6 division titles, 5 NFL championships, and wins in the first 2 Super Bowls. The Milwaukee Brewers beat the Philadelphia Phillies 9-1 yesterday to keep from getting swept in the series. Milwaukee now plays a pair of games against the Twins today and tomorrow. Cloudy with a good chance of rain and thunderstorms across the state today. Some of the storms could be strong in the afternoon with heavy rain and gusty winds. We'll have highs in the 60s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. St. Louis hockey fans have been waiting almost half a century for this. That's Kenny Albert on the call for NBCSN last week. If you didn't hear him over the deafening roar, he was saying the St. Louis Blues haven't been in the Stanley Cup Finals in 49 years, and tonight they are back, facing the team that knocked them out of the series back in 1970, the Boston Bruins.
The Blues have never won the Stanley Cup, but when that franchise was first born, they seemed like they'd be the next sports dynasty.
It's funny, they went to the finals their first 3 years, 68, 69, 70. And, you just sort of thought that was just going to be a regular thing.
Dan O'Neill is a sports reporter in St. Louis and wrote the book When the Blues Go Marching In. He says the team's hard luck has made it pretty hard to be a hockey fan in a baseball town like St. Louis.
People have the impression that St. Louisans get up in the morning and play catch before they eat breakfast. The Cardinals have dominated the landscape here, and so the Blues have always sort of played second fiddle. Now that's changed. If you drive around St. Louis now and you flip around the radio stations, they're talking about the Blues, and that's really unusual.
Yeah, because most years over the past half century, the Blues have not given fans very much hope. Earlier this year, they were in last place, but since then, they've thrilled St. Louis with a turnaround.
They don't have a bunch of high-scoring forwards or household names, but they've just been an incredibly resilient team that doesn't get down. So that's why I think they have a chance, and it should be a terrific series.
The Blues play the Bruins tonight in Boston.
Several times a day, members of the Army's Old Guard play taps at Arlington National Cemetery, at a funeral, or at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. That lone bugle can signify both the end of the day and also a time to reflect. In the middle of all of the partisan fighting in this country, this Memorial Day, we're going to take a few moments to reflect with Tom Cotton. Cotton was a platoon leader in the Old Guard. He served at Arlington between tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tom Cotton is now a Republican U.S. senator, and he's written a book called Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. His book has nothing to do with politics. He told Rachel Martin that it was important to keep politics out of it when talking about Arlington.
It holds a special place in the hearts of our fellow citizens, that it's a place of unity and reconciliation. which is a bit of an irony because Arlington had its start in the Civil War, you know, a time in which Americans raised swords against each other, so much so that the Department of the Army had to take an old plantation across the river and turn it into a graveyard for our war dead because all the cemeteries in Washington were filling up. And I think probably because it had that origin in the ashes of the Civil War, as I describe in Sacred Duty, that it has become an almost mythic place in the hearts of our fellow citizens.
Who are the people who serve in the Old Guard?
It's a diverse group. It's men and women. It's young and old. Some of these are privates coming straight from basic training at age 18. They were plucked out because they were tall and physically fit and had high test scores. And some of them are sergeant majors who have had six or seven deployments.
The precision is notable. You stand at attention. You don't move for 75 minutes sometimes. You're supposed to carry a sword till its tip is a certain distance from the ground. These are just a few examples. But what is the relationship between that kind of precision and honor?
When the family comes into the cemetery, we want them to have that last perfect image of honor. And everything that an Old Guard soldier does, whether it's his level of physical fitness and therefore his image, the cleanliness and precision of his uniform, the way he marches, the way he and his fellow soldiers carry a casket or fire the three-round volley, is all designed to ensure that the family is focused solely on their fallen hero and the military honors rendered to them.
This is very important work. Clearly, it's very sober work. But can you describe something called fallouts?
Yeah, so fallout is when a soldier falls out of ceremony. We have what's called a supernumerary, which is Latin for one above the number. And he generally comes out with the formation and hides behind a nearby tree or bush. So he's there in case someone falls out. So, for instance, I recall a very hot summer day in August of 2007 when I was standing in formation and the last man in the first rank passed out, standing up, fell like a tree that had been cut, just face planted, face forward.
Oh, no.
Now, we're all trained for this, so he just lay there. And no one else moved. The assistant non-commissioned officer in charge came over and scooped him up underneath by putting his hand under a ceremonial belt and dragged him off the field. And the supernumerary marches out in ceremonial form, picks up that soldier's rifle, stands back up, and falls into formation.
Wow.
So you still have a perfect formation. It's an example of the level of detail that the Old Guard takes our ceremonial and our funeral planning to,
yeah.
That even for those very rare contingencies when a soldier can't make it through a formation, that we have a plan in place to ensure that the ceremony or the funeral ends exactly as it would have, even if nothing had happened.
You served in the Old Guard between two deployments. The United States was engaged in two wars at the time, and you saw visibly the cemetery change as a result of the remains that were coming home.
I did, unfortunately, and I can see that today. In fact, I performed a group burial in October of 2007 for the crew and passengers of EZ-40, a Black Hawk helicopter shot down just outside of Baghdad earlier that year. And there are photos that you can see of me and the other Old Guard soldiers performing that funeral. And behind us is the eastern half of Section 60, where those killed in action in the War on Terror are buried. And it's almost entirely green field. And today, if you go to the cemetery, you'll see that Section 60 is almost entirely filled with new headstones. Not all from Iraq and Afghanistan, but the lion's share. And that's a toll that is a reminder of us of just the kind of sacrifice that our warriors and their families have to lay down on the altar of freedom to keep this country free.
The book is called Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. It's written by Senator Tom Cotton. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us at 3 this afternoon for all the latest news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4. A minute before 9 now. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is next.
Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, producers of Press House Brandy, a recreation of the brandy distilled before Prohibition. Wisconsin Old Fashioned and other brandy cocktail recipes can be found at wollersheim.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Every detail counts and every memory matters. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki to take care of all your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.